2 Corinthians chapter 10 is on page 968 in the Pew Bible. If you don't own a Bible, that's yours to keep if you want it. So we're going to read, I'm going to read the whole chapter, and then we're going to back up and kind of talk about it together. So chapter 10. I, Paul, myself entreat you, by the meekness and gentleness of Christ, I who am humble when face to face with you, but bold toward you when I'm away, I beg of you that when I'm present, I may not have to show boldness with such confidence as I count on showing against some who suspect us of walking according to the flesh. For though we walk in the flesh, we're not waging war according to the flesh. For the weapons of our warfare are not of the flesh, but have divine power to destroy strongholds. We destroy arguments and every lofty opinion raised against the knowledge of God, and take every thought captive to obey Christ, being ready to punish every disobedience when your obedience is complete. Look at what is before your eyes. If anyone is confident that he is Christ, let him remind himself that just as he is Christ, so also are we. For even if I boast a little too much of our authority, which the Lord gave for building you up and not for destroying you, I will not be ashamed. I do not want to appear to be frightening you with my letters, for they say his letters are weighty and strong, but his bodily presence is weak and his speech of no account. Let such a person understand that what we say by letter when absent, we do when present. Not that we dare to classify or compare ourselves with some of those who are commending themselves. But when they measure themselves by one another and compare themselves with one another, they are without understanding. But we will not boast beyond our limits, but will boast only with regard to the area of influence God assigned us to reach even to you. For we are not overextending ourselves as though we did not reach you. For we were the first to come all the way to you with the gospel of Christ. We do not boast beyond limit in the labor of others, but our hope is that as your faith increases, our area of influence among you may be greatly enlarged, so that we may preach the gospel in lands beyond you without boasting of work already done in another's area of influence. Let the one who boasts boast in the Lord, for it is not the one who commends himself who is approved, but the one whom the Lord commends. One of the more fascinating things I've learned in the last few months is that there is only one place in all four Gospels where Jesus describes himself and his own character. So there are a lot of places in the Gospels where the disciples or the author describes Jesus, or you can look at Jesus' actions and get an idea of what his character is like. But there's only one place where Jesus verbally says, hey, this is what I'm like. And it's in Matthew chapter 11. And in Matthew chapter 11, verse 29, Jesus is telling his disciples, take my yoke upon you, take my teaching upon you, and learn from me, for I am gentle and lowly in heart. That phrase is incredibly similar to verse 1 of chapter 10. Where Paul says, I entreat you, I'm urging you by the meekness and gentleness of Christ. These character attributes, the ones that Jesus lays claim to, the one that Paul is laying claim to, are actually found in several places throughout the New Testament. They're found in the fruit of the Spirit in Galatians 5. They're found in 1 Peter 3, where Peter is telling people, he's like, when you come to your defense, do so with patience and gentleness. Nearly every single author of a letter in the New Testament, Paul, Jude, James, Peter, John, at some point encouraged Christians to hold on to these characteristics of gentleness and humility and meekness and kindness. Like, these are things that in the Christian world are to be praised. Yet, we could easily make the argument that that's not what our culture thinks of when they think of the church. I mean, you've ever sat down and asked someone what they think about when they think of what a Christian is? In the early 1920s, or rather the late 1920s, A professor, Dr. Holmes from Harvard, sat down with Gandhi and he asked him what he thought about Christianity. And this is what Gandhi said. He says, "I believe in the teachings of Christ, but you do not." And he's talking about Christians in general. "Christians, it seems, above all others, are seeking after wealth. Their prosperity there is far more essential to them than the life, liberty, and happiness of others." Now, we can disagree with him, but back in the 1920s, Gandhi, living in impoverished India, a land that had been colonized by Christian missionaries from England, that was his understanding and his viewpoint of what Christianity in general meant. They only care about themselves. They're self-serving. They don't want to lose out on power and wealth. I mean, do we hear that kind of stuff today? If anything, the political cycle of the last 5 to 10 years has brought this to light, that there are some people who are Christian in name. We don't know their hearts. But man, it has been difficult to let go of some political power. Like, this happens to us, and it happens to all of us. We all get defensive in this way when we begin to feel threatened. Right? When we begin to feel that life as we know it, the freedoms and power and influence that we've had up till now, begin to be taken away. And on some level, we all are in this place where we're like, okay, how do I maintain what I have? How do I maintain this status? But there is a way that the church is to react in that time of threatening that is completely different from the world, completely different from what Gandhi has saw, and completely different from what we have seen from other political and Christian leaders. And Paul shows us here. We see the difference here between this desire to maintain the status quo at all cost and this desire to just continue to honor and glorify God. And we see the difference between Paul and these false teachers that have come up in Corinth. Now, up till now, like the first half of 2 Corinthians, from 1 to 7, is Paul reestablishing this relationship with them. And in the midst of that, he's talking about, he's defending his type of ministry, this new covenant, spirit-filled ministry. Why does he preach the gospel, basically? But at the end of chapter 7, we realize that the Corinthians, at least a large portion of them in the church, have repented and they want to reconcile. And so then in chapter 8, there's this turn in the letter where Paul's like, all right, I'm coming to you. And here's some things you need to know is going to come, going to happen. So chapter 8 and 9, Paul's like, you remember a year ago when you said you were going to raise money for these churches in Jerusalem that were suffering? Well, I want to collect that. And then here in chapter 10, through the rest of the letter, he says pretty much what he says in verse 2. I'm going to show boldness with confidence to these false teachers. Chapters 10, 11, and 12 of 2 Corinthians are some of my favorite because Paul is at his most sarcastic. Like, you can see the agitation in him. Almost to the point you're like, I don't know if this is actually Christian of you to say it this way, Paul. Like, but he makes a point in verse 1 of chapter 10 to say, I, Paul. So this is, for most part, a letter that Paul and Timothy and a few others are writing, but now he's like, this is personal. And in this chapter of chapter 10, he outlines or alludes to at least four different accusations, maybe more, that these false teachers are making against his own personal character. It's like a character assassination. And the reason for that is that what Paul actually says in verse chapter 11, is like he calls them super apostles with air quotes. They know that if they can discredit Paul, then there will be this power vacuum that one of them can just be sucked up into. The key to the heart of the Corinthians is to make them get rid of Paul. And so they've been attacking him. And here are some things they've been attacking him, if you want to follow with me. The first one is they're basically saying Paul's a coward. He's two-faced. You can see these air quotes kind of when that little section where he says, I who am humble when face to face with you, but bold to you when I'm away. He's a coward. He talks a big game, but he's nothing. He's all bark, no bite. The second one is down actually in verse 8. For even if I boast a little too much of our authority, which the Lord gave for building you up and not for destroying you. So this accusation that he leans too heavily on his authority, he's abusive. He's authoritative. Like he's always coming over. Remember who started you. And the third one he alludes to is down in verse 9 and 10. He says, I don't want to appear to be frightening you with my letters, for they say, and this is a direct quote, his letters are weighty and strong, but his bodily presence is weak and his speech of no account. The accusation here is that he's unimpressive. And in Greek culture, that was horrible. I mean, these are guys, they prided themselves on having the best philosophical speakers of the day. They had a lineup of TED Talk speakers. And here's Paul, and he's not impressive. He doesn't know how to do a sermon outline. And he even says in chapter 11, yeah, I'm not that great of a speaker. I know that. Some scholars believe that at this point he's probably hunched over, balding, short, little man. And honestly, when we get to chapter 11, you'll read all this list of how he's been beaten down throughout his missionary career. I mean, you can't expect much from that. And so they're appealing to him. It's like, he's unimpressive. Nobody outside the church is going to want to listen to him. You're not going to be bringing people in. You're just going to stagnate. He'll be ineffective. But then the fourth one is down in verse 14. He says, for we are not overextending ourselves. This idea that Paul's just too busy for you. Look, he's up in Macedonia right now. He's with the Philippians and the Thessalonians. He has the Galatian churches. He's planting all these churches. He doesn't really care about you. He just wants to use you. He's too busy. Like, here's what's funny to me, is that if you line up all four of these, they just don't make sense. So on one hand, they're saying, you know, Paul's weak, and he's not really able to influence anybody. But on the other hand, Paul's abusive and he's doing too much. Like, it just doesn't make sense. You can't be all four of those things at the same time. And so they're just positioning themselves. They're like politicians and religious leaders who they want to keep the focus on them, and so they attack. They're just attacking him, hoping that Paul will get down in the mud with them. And Paul has refused to do so. And even here in chapter 10, where he turns the corner to defending himself, he's going to do it in some ways that are just unique to him and to Christ and to all those who trust in Jesus. They've underestimated Paul. Paul doesn't care about his status at all. And we know this because you can see it at the very end of this chapter, verse 17 and 18. He says, let the one who boasts, who brags, boast in the Lord. For it's not the one who commends himself who's approved, but the one whom the Lord commends. That quote, let the one who boasts, boast in the Lord. On one hand, Paul's already quoted this in 1 Corinthians chapter 4. So this is a recurring issue with the Corinthian church. They are easily impressed. But it's a quote from Jeremiah chapter 9, verses 23 through 24. And here's what that says. Jeremiah is talking to the Israelites, who are also easily impressed. Let not the wise man boast in his wisdom. Let not the mighty man boast in his might. Let not the rich man boast in his riches. But let him who boasts boast in this, that he understands and knows the Lord. Yeah, they might be wiser than me, but I know the Lord. They might be physically stronger than me. They may be way more impressive than me. I'm actually probably guaranteeing you that. But I know the Lord. And they may have a ton more money than I have. But I know Jesus. Wisdom fades. People age. Money comes and goes. But I know Jesus. And he never leaves. He never forsakes. So Paul doesn't have to fight that way. And in our increasingly political, cultural, religious environment where everything is becoming more black and white and there's no room to walk the gray or to even cross over on the lines, we need to chapter 10 here to give us a way forward. And how do we engage healthily with those who are confronting us, who have different opinions than we have, who honestly may hate the very thing that we believe and trust in the most, the gospel of Jesus Christ. And what we see here in chapter 10 is that knowing the Lord for Paul, knowing the Lord for us, allows us to face conflict with compassion and conviction. I'll say that again. Knowing the Lord allows us to face conflict with compassion and conviction. And so where does this compassion and this conviction come from in knowing the Lord? And there are three things. And they're actually found in the first six verses here of chapter 10. Six things to help us be compassionate people who have deep conviction. And the first one is this. Keep in mind what the real fight is. Keep in mind what the real fight is. Look at what Paul says. He says in verse 3, though we walk in the flesh, we're not waging war according to the flesh. So there's a fight. There's a war here. For though we walk in the flesh, we're not waging war according to the flesh. For the weapons of our warfare are not of the flesh, but have divine power to destroy strongholds. We destroy arguments and every lofty opinion raised against the knowledge of God, and take every thought captive to obey Christ. Understand what the real fight is here for Paul. The real fight isn't for his respect. And it isn't that he be dignified. And it isn't even that people like him and get off of his back. The real fight here for Paul is that people see God for who he really is. There's a spiritual war going on that Paul's a part of. And it's not for acclaim and praise, but it's for people's souls. Like these teachers, they're fighting to just have status, the privilege. They believe that if Paul comes back to Corinth, that's the end for them. And so they're trying to defeat Paul on this very outward, formal level. What they don't understand is that Paul doesn't care. He doesn't care. He is concerned about the Corinthians' soul. And I think he's also concerned about the false teacher's soul. Because look, he's going after thoughts and ideas, not people. And his hope is he's going to take those thoughts and ideas, like kind of this war metaphor, I'm going to take them hostage and retrain them to obey Jesus, to follow Christ. And that phrase in verse 6, it can be a little confusing, being ready to punish every disobedience when your obedience is complete. What he's talking about there, remember, he's writing to the Corinthian church. He's saying, once I know everything is good between you and I, then I'll focus on those guys. Then we'll come after those. And I'm coming after these lies that they're believing. Paul understands what a lot of movies and TV shows try to tell us, right? Movies like The Matrix, Wayward Pines, the TV show. My favorite version of this kind of movie is They Live from the late 80s. Anyone else? These movies are all based on this reality. Like, you know, there's actually, the world that we see isn't all there is. There's actually these aliens or these machines or these monsters that people are trying to hide from us, right? They just want us to be sucked into entertainment and worried more about our day-to-day lives than this ultimate evil that's out there. Paul's like tapped in to the reality of life, which is, no matter what people think about you here, it all really comes down to what the Lord thinks of you there. At the end of the age, we all die, and He'll be standing there. So I don't care if you like me. don't care if you hate me, but out of love for you, I'm going to try to tear down the lies that you're believing. So hopefully you see the real Lord and the real God. So keep in mind the real fight. Secondly, keep in mind the real issue. And this comes back to what we just talked about. Paul's mentality, his focus, is I'm coming after strongholds, these arguments, these opinions that are raised against the Lord. I'm seeking to destroy those things. And this is important to understand because Paul uses his same language in verse 8 when he says, the Lord gave me this authority as an apostle for building you up, not destroying you. I'm coming to destroy lies, not people. These teachers, they're wanting to destroy Paul. They're trying to defame his character. They're trying to mock him. They're trying to make people hate Paul. And Paul's like, I'm not coming to make you hate anybody. Now, when you get into chapter 11, he calls these false teachers basically angels of Satan. And we're like, that's pretty bad. But Paul, once again, he's talking on a spiritual plane. And his goal is to destroy lies about who God is. When you are faced with attack, because of your faith, because of the lifestyle that your faith in Christ leads you to live, and because of the convictions that your faith gives you, understand they may be attacking you, but the source of that attack is always lies about who God is. Always. We must remember what the real issue here. There is a lie deep in the heart of all of us that wants to doubt God is good, that doubt God that has authority, that doubt that God actually knows what's best for us. And even as followers of Christ, we're still wrestling with this, aren't we? So when you make a decision to try to honor the Lord and people don't understand it and maybe even mock it or make fun of it, in that moment, understand the real issue isn't you, but for them, there is a lie about about God lying in their heart. There are these walls that are keeping them up from seeing the truth of who God is. That's what we're fighting. It does us no good to enter into the mud and respond to people in the way that they attack us. And the third thing is, and this is the key to it all, is keep in mind the attitude of Christ. Paul comes at this problem with compassion and with conviction. With compassion and conviction. He's dealing with this conflict with those two things. He's dealing with it with compassion, and you can see this in verse 1. I, Paul, myself, entreat you by the meekness and gentleness of Christ. He's saying basically, by the humility and kindness of Christ, I'm coming to you thinking about your needs. And I'm coming to you with great patience and gentleness to help you walk through this and work this out. He has compassion and empathy for them. But then there's also conviction here. He talks about this when he says, I'm coming with boldness, to show boldness with such confidence as I count on showing against the ones who suspect us of walking according to the flesh. This boldness is not what we typically think about with boldness. See, when we think about boldness, we're thinking about loud, maybe abrasive, in your face. You know, maybe we would talk about boldness in a way like this person's bold in that they're unafraid to say what everybody else is afraid to say, but to do it in a way that stands out and might be actually rude. That's not what Paul is talking about. That's not what this word bold refers to. It actually refers to courage. Paul is coming with a courage, and it's a courage that's more defined and linked in with his compassion. And so instead of thinking of loud and abrasive, think of Rosa Parks on the bus. Quiet little lady who just refused to do what and follow a racist law. She never gave a speech. She just acted for what was right. And in that way, every single one of us, every day, have a way and a step that where we can be bold, and we may never have to open our mouth to do it. It's simply living out what is right and true with courage, with conviction. See, these teachers are confusing Paul's character, his humility and his compassion with weakness. And that's going to happen with us. It's going to happen with anybody. When you're compassionate to someone who... I think my battery's just died. Hey, Tim, can you switch me to this? I thought the batteries were fine. When you're compassionate to someone who has different political beliefs than you, when you're actually empathetic with someone who grew up outside the church and is struggling to actually believe in God, maybe even vocally says they hate God, when you act in such a way where the lines aren't there, and you're willing to love and be compassionate, to do what Christ says in loving our enemies, people are going to be confused. Like, this year, I have seen a headline, a news headline, based on the fact that former President Bush gave Michelle Obama a piece of candy. Like, somehow that made local and national news. Like, this kindness, like, that's the kind of political age we're in right now. And so for sure you can expect people just ain't going to understand. And that's okay. And then likewise, when you disagree with others and you actually try to convince them of the truth of the gospel, they may view you as being authoritarian. And they may view you as being a judge. And they may actually try to quote scripture to you like, "Judge not, lest ye be judged." They may not be able to reference where that scripture comes from, but they know it. In that moment, they'll misunderstand what you're trying to do. And you know, and here's the thing, that quote, "Judge not, lest ye be judged," is rooted in the Sermon on the Mount, which is the most difficult and stringent moral ethic of the whole Bible. We have to understand that the real issue there is there's a lie about God that they're believing, and the real fight is for their soul. And so we're going to keep in mind, I want to be compassionate. I want to have conviction, but I also want to be compassionate. And so where do we find the strength to endure this? Because I think in every single one of us, there's a natural tendency for us to lean one way or the other. Some of that's just based on how we grew up, and some of that's just based on where we're at now. But we have, both of those things have to be intermingled. Because if they're not, we're defective. If you're all compassion without conviction, you're pretty helpless. You're a good shoulder to cry on, but you're not able to actually give them any advice or point them in any direction that could actually be beneficial to them. Because you're going to be afraid of offending them. That's kind of where we're at right now with a lot of people. They want empathy, but they don't really want direction. Or they want to empathize, but they don't really want to step out and say, this is what is true about who God is. And because of that, we're just kind of swirling around the whirlpool a little bit. But on the other hand, for all conviction with no compassion, we're heartless. And this is my tribe growing up. What's right is right, and you just got to do it. Doesn't matter what your reasons are. No empathy, no understanding, no caring. Neither one of those glorifies Christ. Because neither one of those display His truth and His grace. Neither one of those display the gentleness and the kindness of Christ. So how do we do this? First thing we see from Paul is that he embraced his weakness. You're going to see this over and over again in chapters 10, 11, and 12. He is embracing his weakness. Out of all the men in the New Testament, no one was smarter than Paul outside of Jesus. This is a man who could embrace his strength if he wanted to, but he refuses. He actually says, this is what he means When he says in chapter verse 3, for though we walk in the flesh, though I walk as a human being with limitations and weaknesses, I wage war according to the weapons and warfare and divine power of God. Paul knows he's not impressive. Some of us just have to admit we're not that impressive. Or to put it another way, some of us need to admit that we're wanting people to think of us as more impressive than we are. A failure to embrace our weaknesses will leave us in a place where we will find it difficult to be compassionate, or we will find it difficult to hold tightly to conviction, because we're always concerned about what someone else thinks about us. But Paul, in embracing his weakness, opens the door up for the power and the strength and the Spirit of God to work. And even though he doesn't outline these weapons here, and he writes about them elsewhere, the point I think he's trying to make is that these weapons actually strengthen him to do what he can never do on his own. Through his character and through conviction, actually show people the good news of Jesus Christ. So you got to embrace your weakness if you want to endure with compassion and conviction. But then secondly, you have to know that the Lord is there. If you're going to embrace your weakness, you also have to embrace the strength of the Lord. This is why Paul says, let the one who boasts boast in the Lord. Let my boast is that I know Jesus. This whole section crescendos in chapter 12. When he says, for the sake of Christ, I'm content with weaknesses, insults, hardships, persecutions, and calamities. For when I'm weak, then I'm strong. Like, both of these are cultivated in us as we meditate on and know the good news of Jesus Christ. When we know, we look into the reality, you know, I am so sinful, so messed up, so evil-hearted that God had to send Jesus to die for me. If you embrace that, what room is there for pride in you? A person who embraces that mentality and embraces the truth about their sinfulness in that way, they don't walk with a swagger. It is impossible to walk with your chest puffed out when you know that but for the grace of God, you'd be condemned to hell. But to also know that you're so loved that Christ willingly came to die for you. Man, that truth destroys fear and insecurity, doesn't it? To know that even in all your sinfulness and all of your shame and guilt, that the love of Christ toward you is that he came to die for you. That he's holding out his arms right now, gentle and lowly in heart, waiting for you to just come and just be at rest. What do you got to be afraid of? He knows the worst of you. You're not going to change his mind. What do you have to be insecure about? He knows the worst of you, but yet he is with you. He is your strength. Like the ones who believe the gospel like this, man, they become people of compassion and conviction. We're able to face any conflict with this. People who embrace the gospel like this, man, they become people who are able to empathize with those who they disagree with. They become people who are gracious with those who are in pain. They're there for them, for their good. Even if that pain is coming from a very sinful, shame-filled place, they're there.
but they also become people of integrity and faithfulness who don't forsake the truth. They don't, like, we're not going to go look for trouble, but when trouble comes, we're not going to run either. It creates people who, out of their love for the Lord, because He's His love for you, you become more concerned for His glory and for people's salvation than when you're on with your own glory and praise. Like Paul says in verse 8, my concern is that you're strengthened. In fighting this war, I want you to come out ahead and stronger than you entered into it. And then in verse 13 through 16, my hope in doing even that is that you would be able to send me somewhere else. His concern is all for the glory of God, yet here are these spiritual false teachers, and their main concern is what? We want to stay here. We like it when you praise us. We like it when you adore us. I think this leads us to a place where we have to examine ourselves. Are you more like the false teachers than you care to admit? Are you insecure? Are you worried about what other people think about you and the status they give you? When people disagree with you, are you looking to attack or demean, to accuse them? Or do you show compassion for people across the line? Do you care for people's souls no matter what their ideals are? Listen, we're, as bad as our political landscape may be, we are not in a political crisis. We're in a spiritual one. We are in a crisis where politics have become people's religion. And the hope that they're looking for is not being found, and they are destroying one another for it. In the midst of this, we as a church can enter in with gentleness and kindness to all people, regardless of who they back. This is a grand moment that the Lord has given us, actually display the glory and the grace and the character of Jesus Christ. Do you know the Lord in that way, though? On the back of your loop, there's this commitment to pray. And I know not everyone may be able to make the every other Friday prayer time, but if you haven't already, we can all take part in prayer on a daily basis, just texting prayer to that number. Knowing I'm praying along with the rest of the church through this text this morning. Or maybe it's time that as the summer winds down, you just recommit to getting in the Bible regularly. I know some of us are in growth groups where we're going through the Bible reading plan and some of you aren't. But there's a Bible reading plan in the back, and starting next Monday, we're starting in the New Testament. So what if you just said, all right, starting next week, I'm going to read the Bible reading plan, and my goal is just to be consistently reading about the character and nature of Jesus, to know the Lord. And then lastly, are you willing this morning to take steps to grow in these areas of compassion and conviction? Leader community is coming up. And that's our whole goal. Is how do we address these sensitive issues of gender and sexuality with compassion and conviction? What did it look like for you just to make that a priority and be there? Like, we're not doing these things to fill your schedule, and that's not my hope, but it's really to equip you. Because every day, you're going to be tempted to lay aside your conviction in the name of compassion, or to lay aside your compassion in the name of conviction. But that's not the way of Christ. As one pastor put it, we deeply accept that our loyalty to Jesus puts us on a collision course with the powers of this world, but we're not afraid. You're not going to go there alone. God is with you. His gentle and humble heart His grace and His truth. So let's lay aside all this false boasting and rejoice that we know the Lord. And let's embrace this world with compassion and conviction. Let's pray.